There's some really cool volcanoes outside of Mexico City also, some in day tripping distance. And people go to Mexico City. It's one of my favorite places. So I don't want anyone to take this as a dig on this city, but they just stay in the metro area. They have a wonderful urban vacation. But if you had one extra day to throw in there and you wanted to go see a volcano erupting, in 2 hours, you can be there. And
wow, that's a great, that sounds like an amazing day trip.
Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we welcome Becky Pecora as I attempt every time to stumble over your name. Welcome, Becky.
Hey, guys. It's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You know, it's great to have like an OG guest of the show. I mean, like this is like you're back in the Wayback Machine with like Veracity Observation Deck, right?
Oh, yeah. A couple of different iterations here, but I love how you guys are growing and always trying new things.
We do try. And talking about going way back, so today we're going to talk sight doing, but I was going back through my memory. And when I think we first met, you were doing, was it The Girl in Globe?
It was. So essentially same blog with the least memorable name ever, but at least one person remembered what it was. So I guess it wasn't as bad as I thought.
I don't know. I enjoyed it back in the day. And, you know, obviously with the rebrand to sight doing, I think you really changed a perspective that I had toward travel with sort of kind of when you've made that transition. But I think we're sort of burying the lead. What is sight doing? You want to tell us a little bit about it and kind of how you came about to that idea, that approach?
So sight doing is exactly what it sounds like. It's doing instead of seeing while you're traveling. At its core, it's kind of about engaging with the destination and seeking out experiences that are meaningful to you as an individual. As far as I'm concerned, I think as long as you are getting involved in some way rather than just passively observing from the outside, I think it counts as sight doing. So it's a big, broad definition, but doing something more than just following the guidebook with literally your nose still in the book, not paying attention to what's going around, not just posing for Instagram photos, but trying to leave having experienced where you've been.
It definitely seems like you have a focus on authentic travel and not necessarily following the path or following the crowd, right? And you're trying to kind of blaze your own trail, so to speak. And it definitely seems to show in like kind of the destinations it looks like you're attracted to and the places you seem to gravitate toward.
I do sometimes go to unconventional or less visited places, that's for sure. But I think it's a mindset that you can employ pretty much anywhere and also within the Venn diagram of things that are still interesting to you, right? So if you go to London, there's still 1,000 amazing traditional things to go and see and do. But that doesn't mean that you have to spend your entire week there doing only what's in the guidebook or only what's not in the guidebook. There's still a balance to be found.
So, you know, that you bring up the guidebook and that's such a great point. I mean, I think it's so easy to kind of fall into that comfort zone of saying, oh, hey, if it's in the book, we should do it. And you almost create like these bucket lists or checklists, so to speak. Got to go to the Louvre, got to go to Tower of London, got to see the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace. But, you know, for those things not in the book, do you have a particular strategy or a collection of strategies to sort of identify or find some of those kind of perhaps off the beaten path experiences?
So the good news is the internet is making this easier and easier every day. If you are just kind of putting your toe in and getting started with this, Airbnb experiences are one of the first places I send people now because it's very easy to look through the different activities that individuals around the world have set up. Some of them are very conventional, and some of them are very interesting. So you'll have some people setting up food tours. That's nothing new, but they might have a new twist on things. And other people are coming up with activities that you may not have known exist in that destination. And that's kind of cool. But that one's really easy because you can just go and click buy now with anything that sounds interesting to you. And for travelers that want to put more effort into this, I love looking at places where locals would look. Reddit has really great ideas of what's going on in places. Meetup has a lot of group activities, which is a fun way to meet locals. Facebook events, I hate Facebook in the US, but it's amazing in other countries because it really is how people advertise everything in other parts of the world. That's kind of a good one too. And one of my favorite Google searches is date night ideas in fill in the blank for your destination. Because again, that's kind of what people go out and do in their local area rather than what a tourist might come in and want to do.
There's a lot of good inspiration there. It's funny, you know, with the internet, it does make me think, you know, back in the day, I would go out and buy, go to the bookstore and get a guidebook or go to the library and get a guidebook. But I feel like it's been years since I've done that just because the quantity of stuff, the amount of information is so vast and so many different resources available to us that, you know, maybe a couple of years ago, we might not necessarily have looked at. But, you know, I find the harder part is just filtering, you know, because I really do feel like certain places on the internet these days are just very, very poor places. Like TripAdvisor, for instance, might at one point been a good place. But right now, I find that that's one of the least trustworthy, especially for things like dining and things like that, where I feel like what you're going to find there is usually not going to be really tailored or catered to you. And especially if you're kind of a little bit of foodie or whatever, it's going to be the average person leaving a review on TripAdvisor, which is, I don't necessarily think is I'm in that quite in that population for whatever reason, because I don't agree with a lot of things in there. How do you filter out all the kind of like the information from all the noise, you know, considering, you know, even with Instagram, you know, you see these amazing photos and then you realize a lot of that's good camera work, you know?
Yeah, the Instagram effect is kind of amazing. I am lucky enough at this point that I have very well-traveled friends, including you guys. So I do often reach out to my circle of travel friends to look for personal recommendations when I can. Obviously, that's not always an option, but that firsthand touch from someone that you trust and from someone where you understand their frame of reference is always going to be a great way to kind of filter things. But other than that, a lot of it is just kind of getting good at reading your gut and saying, A, does this seem like something that really is what it looks like? And B, is it something that I care about or that I value? Because there are a lot of popular things out there that might be well-deserved, but just don't necessarily jive with what you're looking for.
Yeah, you definitely seem to need to have a filter. Obviously, reaching out to a network is the easiest probably, but it's sort of just figuring out the, as you said it, the what's right for you. So I think you had mentioned a moment ago that you sort of, and obviously we know this because we follow your travels and you've shared your stories offline, but you really have gone to some places that like aren't really on the larger, I think, people's radar, right? I know that you've been to Belize, I think. You've been to a couple of different places that, you know, maybe I knew the country, but I definitely didn't know the city.
Yeah, that's definitely fair. I think none of the countries really on my list, for the most part, are places that would surprise people, especially not the people who are listening to a podcast like this. But I do tend to go to some towns and cities that maybe get overlooked. I've been to a lot of lesser visited places in Mexico. It's one of my favorite countries, and I seem to find new places there all the time. Same thing with Germany. That's my husband's favorite country. So we're kind of always digging into different places there and just doing weird things. Like I went to a water park in Germany. Why? Because it was July and it was hot. And what do you do for fun? Well, you go splash around in a lazy river. And we got there and there was this crazy festival going on with thousands of people singing along to like what seemed like nursery school songs in the swimming pool. I don't know. It was fun, but we got free hats. We met a lot of people. So I think a lot of it is also just opening yourself up to experiences when you do find them. Sometimes that means throwing away all of your perfectly planned other activities and just saying, hey, this is cool. Let's do this instead.
Sounds memorable. Yeah, and I especially like how you've pretty much covered the entire Pacific coast of South America.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to get to the other side of the continent. It'll happen someday.
it took me dragging him down to Rio last year just on a whim because we found I had some Singapore Crisflyer miles that I had to offload pretty quickly before they expired.
It's funny how, you know, mileage expiration seems to be a major driver of Trevor's travel plans. This is not the only trip I think that the mileage expiration seems to be a strong motivating factor.
I actually think that's fair, though. I mean, circling back to how there's just so many options in this world and how do you filter things out? Sometimes taking what's easy is a legitimate way to plan a trip or to plan an activity or just to go out to dinner. I mean, if you pull up Google Maps on your phone and you're hungry right then and there and you just look within a 10-minute walking radius for something with good reviews, a lot of times that's enough. You don't have to kind of sit and think on every single decision.
You're not
going to
get an argument from me. I've had a lot of pretenses for traveling, and they've been pretty weak pretenses for that matter. Like, oh yeah, I had an orphan segment that I wanted to use, so I just like, let me just randomly go somewhere. Or, oh yeah, you know, I have this extra, you know, I have too much currency for this one country. I might as well go back.
If we're talking about currency, I need to plan about 30 more trips right now.
only 30 more trips.
Those are just the ones with enough cash left over to make it worthwhile. And by enough cash, I mean like maybe $100.
The United Kingdom is the one that gets me the most annoyed because who knew that their you know, money expires, you know, apparently expires like all the time too. So I have like a couple hundred pounds of apparently money I can't use anywhere. I have to go to like the post office to go ahead and exchange it or something. But a nice big public service announcement to our listeners, you know, don't have too many Great Britain pounds. Although they just changed it, so I guess you probably got a couple years left right now before it's funny money again.
I just wonder whether the Queen's currency is more valued or not.
Well, I mean, I would imagine eventually it won't be because they're not going to take it as legal tender, right? You know, it's going to be all the paper money has to have King Charles on it eventually.
No, that's a fair point. I just didn't know if it was a collectible, but I guess a 50-pound note is probably not going to yield more than 50 pounds. So, Becky, you had mentioned that you just kind of happened upon this cool party at the water park. Do you do a lot of, do you try to go to places for particular events or do you just sort of happen into them? I ask because I don't actually ever really focus on events other than perhaps Oktoberfest or maybe a race. But I find that we walk into things far more often. We were in Nice this past June, and they had the Ironman, and we had no idea. We're driving in, and we're like, hey, there's a lot of these barricades and stuff. What's going on here? But do you seek out events, or you just sort of go with the flow and not even really concern yourself about events?
There have been a handful of events I've purposely planned for. Some have worked out great. Some less so, but kind of the opposite approach. Often if I know I'm going to X place on certain dates, if I have free time in my schedule, I might do a little Googling ahead of time to see, hey, is there something going on that weekend? I'm there anyway. And it can be kind of a fun way to fill an afternoon or an evening when you might otherwise just kind of walk around and explore. This kind of lets you walk around in a certain direction where maybe it's still not 100% structured and planned, but you've at least got a neighborhood to head to or something along those lines.
I'll say I'm a sucker for lines. You know, so if I suddenly see a line and I'm like, what is that? What are people lining up for? And then I'm not that I like sitting in line, but a lot of times I'll see a restaurant or I'll see a stand or I'll see something. I'm like, ooh, what is that? And there's a lot of that serendipity, you know, that you end up with when you're traveling. And there's something about that because there's at least a couple of restaurants and other kind of food things where I'm like, oh, that was not something I had any plan for. But then you just stumble on it and you're like, ah. This is amazing. You know, who knew this was there?
Yeah, I think some of those best discoveries, they can be extremely rewarding, but even if they turn out to be average, you've still left with a story and an experience. And that alone can kind of bring those memories to a different place than if you just are following your Google Doc, which I will admit I have some very extensive Google Docs of information. But I also throw them away a lot. And I think I think that's important to kind of know what you want to do, but not be so married to that idea that you're not enjoying the moment.
Yeah, don't overplan, right? Because I mean, I think that's a big trap I think a lot of people fall into. You know, they try to schedule every minute of their day, and they don't leave any space for serendipity or to be able to stumble on something because they got to get to the next thing. So you don't have the luxury of, oh, there's this interesting line where a whole bunch of local people are lined up. Wonder what this is, you know? Of course, then the problem is you're like, oh, how do I pay for this? Like, do they take a credit card? You know?
Did they need a ticket in advance?
Yeah, that's actually the worst. Yeah. Or, you know, are you the only person who's not paying for it with a QR code or something, you know, if you're in China, I guess.
You're feverishly Googling things as you're in line.
I would use that as an excellent opportunity to strike up a conversation with whoever is nearby, though, because, hey, even if you need a QR code and there's no way you can get in, maybe you'll meet someone cool and get a good suggestion for something else to do.
So Becky, could you share with us just a couple examples maybe of some of the kind of fun experiences that you've had? I know that, for example, if I recall correctly, you and your sister had a trip down to Mexico, maybe it was last year, and you were trying to do this one particular activity, and I can't remember what that activity was, for like 2 or 3 days. Maybe it was something on the water, and it was so choppy that it just didn't make sense to get out on the water, and you ended up doing something completely off the cuff, I think on like day 2 or 3. And I remember it like as a positive experience. Maybe my memory's not great, but is that something that was memorable enough to share or perhaps something else from kind of, you know, off the beaten path, so to speak?
Yeah. So I think what you are referring to, I went last fall to Baja California Sur. So most people know of this area as Cabo, but not necessarily a lot of people go outside of Cabo. And I had planned a little road trip driving up to La Paz, which is still what I'm going to call kind of like, some people know about it, some people don't. It's not totally off the beaten path, but since there aren't all-inclusive resorts there, it is a little bit less visited. From there, we were going to keep heading north to a couple of other places. One, Puerto San Carlos, which I guarantee probably nobody has ever heard of, and then further north to Loreto, which is a big Canadian snowbird area, but Americans don't know about it. But we had tried to do several things in La Paz, which was the whole reason we had planned to stop there, one of which was swimming with the whale sharks. And there were no whale sharks. It was well into whale shark season. We weren't there like on the cusp of things. It should have started weeks earlier, but for whatever reason, probably climate change, there just weren't any animals. So we couldn't go out there, no problem. So we ended up chartering this boat from the marina from some guy who looked trustworthy. Maybe we got lucky. And we went out into the area known as kind of Isla Espiritu. It's this huge island, but there are some smaller islands around it. It's not necessarily an under-traveled area. People definitely go there, and there are big group excursions that will take you to all of the so-called best places on this island for snorkeling and hiking and pictures and everything. But we went out with this random guy who said, my boat doesn't go to these places. I go to these other places because this is where my boat will get to on a much smaller watercraft. And we said, okay, sure, whatever. And we ended up spending the whole day watching thousands of other people go to these other places while we were going to coves with nobody else, snorkeling in small coral reefs that the bigger boats couldn't get to, watching dolphins that nobody else saw because they were on a different path. I mean, it was just...
Sounds like serendipity, you know? That was probably worked in your favor.
It was serendipity. And then later that week, we ended up having more problems with weather. So some of our other plans to go out on some other boat tours didn't work out. So we spent time inland instead of on the water. It wasn't really our plan, but we went into an area called Mesquite Canyon, which is in the Sierra de la Giganta mountain range. Stunningly beautiful, kind of miserably hot because you're not on the water, but worth it for a few hours knowing that you can get back to your air conditioning and cold drinks at the end. We also went and hiked at this place called Tabor Canyon, which had a few other locals kind of climbing around the rocks with us, but nobody else around, certainly no tourists or bus groups. So sometimes even when you have fantastic plans, they just get rearranged based on conditions or things you never expected.
Sometimes for the better, it sounds like. Now, I've only snorkeled, I think, in the Pacific coast of Mexico once. Did you end up having to wear a wetsuit? Like, was the water temperature really cold?
Yeah, it was super cold. But also, we didn't have wetsuits because we didn't go out with a real tour. So we just froze a little bit. It was okay.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? You had some cold water therapy or something. You know, you had some thermal spa treatment or something.
Yeah, maybe not every situation is ideal, but you kind of just have to run with it.
You take a chance and you get a great memory from it.
You know, sometimes I have a blind spot for Mexico. I forget how amazing a country it is. Are there some other underrated parts of Mexico that you could share with our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, there's 100 of them.
Probably too long for this episode.
Sure. So way down in the south, not far from the Guatemalan border, is a small colonial town called San Cristobal. San Cristobal de las Casas, I believe, is the full name of the town. It's just a cute colonial area. There is some historical stuff around it that you can do, but it's just got this very easeful vibe to it where all you want to do is walk around and hit the wine bar and the taco stand. It's cute. There's a lot of Mexican tourists there, but not a lot of American tourists there. So what do the Mexicans know that we don't know? I mean, the same way that we might know places in our own state. It's just, it's on their radar. It doesn't mean it's not worth it if you're an American. It just means you haven't heard of it yet.
That's so interesting because, like, you've already mentioned, like, two different areas with different, like, tourist constituencies. Like, the Canadians go here and the Mexicans go here and the Americans don't know anything about it. And I'm like, you don't even think about it, you know, because, you know, obviously you're as an American, you know, you tend to have a certain point of view and you're like, oh, it's not Cancun or it's not Cabo. You know, you know a couple of cities and that's about it. And you don't realize, wait, hey, this is a pretty big country with lots of other places.
Yeah. There's some really cool volcanoes outside of Mexico City also, some in day tripping distance. And people go to Mexico City. It's one of my favorite places. So I don't want anyone to take this as a dig on this city, but they just stay in the metro area. They have a wonderful urban vacation. But if you had one extra day to throw in there and you wanted to go see a volcano erupting, in 2 hours, you can be there.
And wow, that's that sounds like an amazing day trip.
I'm assuming this is something most people can't do in their everyday life at home. So it does sometimes take just that one more Google search or that one question talking to somebody that you meet in town or whatever it is, and just allowing yourself to kind of explore a little bit more or push yourself just a little bit farther.
Yeah, I think Mexico City is definitely one of those areas where renting a guide or somebody who has a car or something, or taking a trip outside the city. There's just so many of these day trips, right? Like there's the Guadalupe Shrine. There's amazing. Is it Aztec? I always get confused which civilization it is, but there's amazing pyramids and other archaeological sites, you know, that are just amazing, you know, UNESCO World Heritage level places, right? That are just everywhere within driving distance of Mexico City.
Yeah, I have started kind of using Mexico City as a base to kind of fly in and out of and spend a day or two there because I love it. And then venturing into these other side trips from there, about 2 hours in a different direction from Mexico City, there's a town called Valle de Bravo. And in the wintertime, it's the spot where all the monarch butterflies go and congregate.
Oh, right. Yeah. When they do their kind of migration, right? From, do they migrate? Is it north to south or south to north? I'm trying to remember now.
So they migrate from the US and Canada into Mexico for the winter so that they can stay warmer. And it's just so incredible to be surrounded by what seems like an infinite number of butterflies. That's really cool. You go in a different area. You can go to silver mines in Taxco. Maybe check the security warnings there before you go there. That state can sometimes be a little bit iffy. It goes back and forth. So it's worth double checking.
So Trevor and I have had at least one trip booked to Mexico City in recent memory, right, that we canceled. So we'll have to see if there's a second one.
Well, now I'm seeing all these good $700 airfares to Mexico City. I really want to get on board.
It's so easy. It's from pretty much anywhere in North America, at least from a hub. If you connect somewhere, I feel your pain. I've been there. But usually the actual flight to Mexico City is maybe 4 hours, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on where you're starting from. But it's extremely easy to get to for a long weekend.
I have a hesitation when I start looking at kind of these tertiary, or I don't even know what fourth or fifth or sixth or just rural cities would be called. Clearly, you've been to a lot of them in Mexico and some other Spanish-speaking countries. Do you speak the language?
I do, so that helps. But in a lot of them, it's not even necessary. And I say that having also been to tertiary places and countries where I don't speak the language. I've been to some really off the beaten place in China. I don't speak any Chinese. I don't even understand how some of their phonetics work or how to use some of their different accents. I wouldn't even necessarily know which dialect to use of different parts of the country. That's how naive I am. So yeah, speaking the language helps. Don't get me wrong, but it's very possible even when you don't.
Do you have any strategies for that? You know, obviously right now with technology that we have, we've got Google Translate and some of those other tools, but you've been doing this, I think, even before Google Translate was nearly as good or connectivity was really as good. Any strategies that you use in preparation for a trip that you might share?
So good old body language does a lot. Hand signals, sign language, they're all fantastic go-tos. Also, Google Images is really great. So if you want to ask, like, if the food is chicken, just literally Google an image of a chicken and point to it and be like, yes, no. That really helps for taxis. Now there's Uber or Didi or Bolt, or, you know, everybody has their own version. But if you are still in a taxi, there was a time in Egypt we couldn't get to where we wanted to be, and I had no idea how to explain where it was. But if you just pop up the image of whatever landmark that is, they'll find it. Google Translate, I actually think sometimes is almost pulling you back or holding you back too much, because when you try to do it with hand signals and body language, somehow it still feels like you're connecting with the person. And oftentimes you'll just smile the right way, and the hospitality kind of shines through. Google Translate, it's very sterile. There's a time and a place for it, don't get me wrong, especially if you're someone who like has allergies and you need to ask a very pinpointed question. But if you're just trying to sort of say hello or thank you, I would use a gesture instead.
No, that's excellent advice. And I think it's so easy to kind of forget and start to rely more on technology. And the reality is, and I say this as a father of a 2.5-year-old, where she knows sign language. You know, we want her to use her words, but she's so much better with just kind of the body language to be able to say what she wants. And I think we kind of have started using that a little bit more when we travel, just because we're using it at home too. But I can tell you that before she was born, I don't think I was as big into trying to use the, you know, motions, hand motions and everything. And it's funny, just for our listeners, we are on camera, and there have been various times when Becky was talking where Tom was literally balking like a chicken or making other funny motions. And Becky, you were able to just solidly keep going without just breaking out laughing. So absolutely,
I wouldn't have a problem if you break down laughing. I mean, I think we have to have I think we haven't quite met our quota of laughing on this episode.
I'm pretty sure that your next Patreon offering should actually just be streaming the video instead of audio only. There's probably people that would pay to see this.
We're working on it. One of these days we'll get that figured out.
Oh, if only I hit the record for the video too. Oh gosh. One of these days we'll get that. So since you sort of brought up China, One of the trips that I think, I can't remember if we talked about this on a previous podcast or not, but it was so long ago and it's such a cool little experience, as I recall. You went to, Harbin, China for the ice show?
I am totally going to butcher this because as I said, my Chinese language skills are very lacking, but it's like a three syllable word. So it's Harbin. I can't do it quickly. But yes, so this is way, way north China for listeners who aren't familiar. It's on the Russian border. So there are some really cool Russian influences that kind of cross border, although it is still very much a Chinese city. In my head before I went there, I was like, oh, I'm going to this small town in China. But because every city in China is massive, it was still millions of people and extremely spread out and yeah, not the small town I was envisioning in my head, but they have what I believe is the world's largest ice and snow festival every January, might bleed into February. It's usually over by Chinese New Year. And it is just this incredible experience of snow sculptures, ice sculptures, winter sports, but also people watching. If you just put a million of your favorite people in one place at the same time, and you want to see how they take selfies and how they react to things and how they try and stay warm when it's about minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit, it makes for quite the experience.
Oh, I love people watching. I can only imagine how that is.
They were all watching me. I don't know what you were thinking.
Oh, well, yeah. I guess a fair skin, a Westerner. I know that we had a trip to China, Beijing. My wife and I and her mother, we went, and so many little girls wanted to take pictures with my wife because she had the blue eyes.
Yeah, it was a pretty big draw for Singapore people. And it was kind of funny. At the time, I was living in Buffalo, New York, so not exactly like a warm tropical place. So I was actually probably more adjusted to the temperature than a lot of the other visitors there. But just watching people come in with, I mean, they didn't have proper winter gear. They had no idea how to prepare for this. It was, if I didn't feel bad for them, it would be entertaining.
I can only imagine. You've grown up, you've lived in Singapore all your life, and now you're suddenly in the Arctic tundra. Hey, I just want to put a little caveat for our listeners. The two trips that I've brought up, literally, we didn't pre-discuss this at all. I really feel like if I needed to pick a charades partner and Tom was unavailable, I would pick you because like I gave you like two or three words and you were like, I know exactly what you're talking about and here's the story. That is incredible recall.
Yeah, so that's the entire point of sight doing is that you have an experience that's so meaningful that it sticks with you and you remember it because nobody remembers the one statue that they went and saw somewhere because it was famous or because somebody said, you have to go see this. Nobody remembers that, but you absolutely remember things where you take the time to really kind of dive in and, connect with.
So well said. Although I will say, I think everybody will remember where, well, obviously where and when they first saw Le Mannequin Pis.
I was somewhat thinking of that one in my head.
So. Yeah, what an underwhelming statue at that, you know, like you never realize how tiny it is, right?
It's like 12 inches tall. But for some reason, everybody in the world, at least everybody who's been to Belgium has seen it.
They have so many other things. They've got waffles. They've got beer. They've got, what is it? They've got NATO and everybody's going for the pissing boy statue.
And you get the moulet, you know, get some muscles.
Ooh, there you go. So we've kind of gone from the Americas. We've kind of gone over to the Pacific. So I guess that way, as I'm using hand motions and our listeners can't actually see, but it sounds funny at least. Any experiences down, shall we say, down under?
I have been to both Australia and New Zealand once each. So basically, I've just barely crossed them off the list. There's 1,000 more things to see down there. I didn't necessarily do those the way that most people do either, but you know, that's par for the course with me. I went to Australia and spent most of my time in Tasmania, which not usually a first-time visitor's main spot, but it's what clicked with me. It was what kind of intrigued me. And honestly, if you ever have a chance to go there, I would recommend it. It's gorgeous. It's easy to get around, really friendly people, although that's probably true in everywhere in Australia.
What is that second largest city in Australia? I don't know. Maybe Trevor can help me out. You know, what is that?
Well, you know, I was actually thinking about that because was it you, Becky, that took, I guess, a ferry from Tassie up to Melbourne? Or am I thinking someone else?
It must be someone else.
Drink time, by the way. Drink time.
Sorry, there is a drinking
there's
game.
There's a little tradition in what is it, travel stories, right?
I don't know if we should assume it has something to do with Trevor's favorite city in the world.
It does.
I don't know if it's my favorite city in the world, but it's a very nice city that has a uniquely mispronounced name or frequently mispronounced name. Well, you know, from the observation deck, we used to have the drinking game for the Lufthansa first class. And so we retired that when Joe Chung came on this podcast and we were talking Australia and apparently I got called out on Miles to Memory for how I pronounce Melbourne. And so now Tom's goal every episode is to get me to say it at least once.
I've been successful lately. You know, we managed to get there. Sorry to interrupt Australia time. Back to our show.
No. A little humor bit for those that might not have heard all of our episodes, but here is chuckling about Melbourne. But I do remember you doing something in Tasmania. What was your favorite thing that you were able to do there?
I mean, picking one thing, is that possible?
Yeah, way to put somebody on the spot there, you know, Trevor.
Yeah. I know. Well, I know you do a lot of hiking, but was there something other than hikes that jumped out at you, like a nature sanctuary or I don't like to call them zoos, but
a lot of what makes Tasmania special is just all of the easily accessible wildlife that there's there. Wildlife is obviously never guaranteed, but I must have seen 10,000 wombats. So I think that counts as close to guaranteed. Plus wallabies, platypus. I mean, all of these iconic Australian creatures. So that's cool. Glowworms, quolls, which are these really cool kind of evil rodent things. I don't really know how to describe them. Not quite as evil as a Tasmanian devil, which we did try and fail to see.
Those Tasmanian devils are awfully cute until they show you their teeth. I'm just going to say it. They look cute until you see their teeth. Then you're just like, whoa, now I see why you have that name.
We did see one on a game cam that was positioned outside of this cabin that we rented in the middle of nowhere. And my husband thinks that counts as seeing one because it was like outside our front door at 3 a.m. But I don't think it counts if all I did was see a picture that says he was there. But it is still kind of cool knowing how close they are or how close they were.
I don't feel like I'd sleep as soundly that way. So we've kind of covered a lot of the geographic area. We might jump back to geography for a moment, but you mentioned a cabin. I know that you seem to like pursue hotels, you know, traditional lodging arrangements, probably the least out of anybody that I know. Do you have any strategies that sort of work best with that for you? I know that you've found, I mean, cool little cabins that you shared both domestically and internationally. And I think you've found apartments too in some of the European cities. I'm trying to remember if that was you or Dia, because I know Dia finds a ton of great apartments too.
You're giving me way too much credit. I mean, the advent of Airbnb and Vrbo and rental sites of that nature makes this incredibly easy. I'm certainly not inventing something or doing something that nobody else could recreate. I like hotels, but a lot of places I go don't have a lot of hotels, which means you have to get a little bit more creative sometimes.
Any kind of like red flags or you know, kind of lessons learned from some of the short-term rental market? Because I've definitely made some mistakes. I think I've seen great, you know, pictures of things on Airbnb and then realized, oh wait, I wasn't getting the whole thing. I was getting like a room in this house. Or, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, what happened to the pool that's supposed to be here? I'm like, okay, maybe they may have misrepresented it a little bit or something. Anything that you watch out for, you know, from kind of personal experience, having done some of the non-traditional lodging that's available in some of these areas?
I'm not sure there's a shortcut other than actually reading 1,000 reviews. Unlike a Hyatt, where you can reasonably expect that all 200 rooms are more or less the same, that won't be true when you get on somewhere like Airbnb and you see 200 listings. They will not all be the same. Red flags for me, I read more of the negative reviews than the positive ones. People throw out 5 stars for things that I would never give 5 stars to. I mean, if they put in their actual words that these 3 things were wrong, I'm like, then why is it still a 5 out of 5? I mean, you just listed things that aren't right. But when you read people's negative reviews, people who are willing to go out of their way to say, hey, this wasn't perfect. Sometimes it's things you can live with. Sometimes it's not. I really like reading responses from Airbnb hosts. If they write back in a calm and even keeled demeanor, which I mean is sometimes hard to tell from writing, then I take that as a good sign that they're trying to make things right. But when they just kind of blast the guest back, I take it as they don't care about your experience. That's usually a big red flag. Pictures are useful, especially if there's user submitted pictures. Rentals on booking.com, people can submit their own pictures, but Airbnb doesn't let you do that. So that's one reason to maybe look at a different platform. But a lot of it goes back to intuition, and a lot of it goes back to just being willing to take a chance. And I'm someone who can pretty much go with the flow if things aren't perfect.
Yep, fair enough. Sounds like do your homework. It sounds like the tip of the day.
Yeah, and do more homework when you're staying for a week than when you're staying for 2 nights.
That's a good point. The more investment in homework you should do.
And that's an interesting tip there with booking.com. I just happened upon it for a rental earlier this summer. I didn't realize you could put up your own photos. So that's a nice little feature. The more and more I hear about Airbnb, I just get more and more scared about using it. I hate to say. There are so many other good tools too, sites as well.
I personally, and this is not truly measured, but it does seem like Airbnb in other countries is a much more reputable source than in the US. There tend to be a lot fewer fees in other countries where the price is just the price. And also it seems often like people are, if it's just a room, it's often a room in an established bed and breakfast that might have been around for a decade, but now they're just using Airbnb as another way to market themselves. Same thing with rentals. Maybe it's been a ski rental through whatever local agency for years and years, but now they're doing the direct bookings through Airbnb. So it does seem more established in other countries and a lot easier to deal with.
That's a great tip. It's so easy to forget that what you see on the US sites is not always the same thing you see overseas. I mean, you made the mention of Facebook as being a really good site for finding things in overseas as well, which I definitely made a personal note for that one because I don't really think of the Facebook ads at all. They just seem annoying to me. But as you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, oh, I did see some interesting experiences when we were just in Europe. So Becky, if we could pivot, you did a bucket list trip that I think everyone or perhaps the majority of our listeners, I know absolutely myself, really have it on our lists. And I think you shared some of it. I think you did this cruise last year to Antarctica. Am I remembering right?
Yes. So I went to Antarctica last March. That for people who aren't familiar with, March is kind of the end of their season. It was a trip that I have been wanting to go on for years and years. I had been diligently saving a little bit at a time, not as fast as I wanted to, because I refused to give up my entire travel budget to make it happen. So I was trying to do two things at once. And then a Black Friday sale rolled around and I jumped on it about a year earlier than I thought my budget would allow. And it was, for me, and for I think a lot of other people, a trip of a lifetime, not just because of the prestige of the name or the fact that very few people go there, but because it is one of the few places in the world that is both unexplored, but also a true expedition, because conditions are rapidly changing, especially at the end of the season when I went. You don't necessarily know where you're going, which bays or which coves or which harbor, it might be a little bit of a strong term here, but which GPS coordinates or which routes you're taking until it's happening. And even as I was there and the captain would announce, this is where we're going to be tomorrow morning, and then it would change because you really just have to work with the elements rather than working against them. And that entire travel style is very rewarding in a way that is hard to recreate on your own.
I'm just speechless. I mean, I remember seeing the photos, but that was so well put. So in that kind of expedition, was that one of the smaller ships or one of the larger ships?
I went with Quark Expeditions. I believe all of their ships are 200 passengers or less. Mine was closer to 120. So there are actually more ways than you might believe to get down to Antarctica. But the main things to keep in mind is that there can only be 100 people landing on the continent at any given time. This is set up by international treaty. So the bigger the ship, the more passengers that there are, the less time you will spend on solid land, because you have to split that time with 100 people at a time. A lot of the big ships, so if you see somebody like Celebrity, a mainstream cruise line, advertise that they go to Antarctica, they will never step foot on land. It's just not something they do. But it is still an extremely scenic sail. You will still see many, many things, like from the balcony or from the public spaces. And they may or may not take you out on Zodiac or smaller watercraft to try and get you closer to the coastline or to do some wildlife sightings. But the really small boats, we're talking 100, 200 passengers, those are the ones that give you the most opportunity to get up close and personal.
And so I'd imagine that you were able to get on land. Was it just the one time or was it multiple times?
Yeah, I stepped foot on land, I want to say, in three different places. It might have been four. And there were also many Zodiac rides that I took. This is not necessarily a negative to be on the water on the Zodiac. A lot of what makes Antarctica extremely amazing is just the icebergs that are in the water. So you don't want to be on, you don't want to step on those, but you might want to sail somewhat closely. Again, distance is important here. Watching the penguins on shore is sort of interesting, but watching them swim in the water from a Zodiac where you're kind of at their level, and they're fast, and you'll never see them be fast on land because they're just awkward as all get out when they're trying to walk. But when they're swimming, they're really cool. Or to watch a seal try and chase a penguin and, you know, feed on it for dinner. It's like an African safari, but in the water and in Antarctica. So being in the Zodiac is not necessarily a less than experience. I think it's just as rewarding as actually being on land. And even when you are on land, they usually have very small areas roped off as where you are supposed to be, both for your safety, because it's not always, it can just be difficult terrain, let's say. But also they don't want to lose anybody. They don't want you to get lost. Weather changes quickly. And I also think it is to still keep 99% of the continent pristine without human touch on it. So when you are on land, it's actually a little bit anticlimactic. because it's you and 50 or 100 people standing in, I don't know, a quarter mile or something like that of each other. It's not that far usually.
I can just imagine like the Simpsons episode for that. You know, everybody in this small little, smaller than a football field area, just kind of standing around looking at the one penguin that just happens to kind of waddle by.
Well, the good news is there's hundreds of penguins. And I think my favorite was the elephant seals because they are just ridiculously oversized and they're angry. And it's fun to watch angry animals, at least when you're a little bit away from them.
I never knew such a thing existed. I'm going to have to Google what this elephant seal looks like.
It kind of looks like probably what you think it does.
So did you end up booking like about 6 months in advance, like 12 months in advance? Like how far out did you end up booking this trip?
I always imagined I'd be booking a year or two in advance, but I booked on Black Friday for a March sailing. So it was maybe 100 days notice. But to be fair, I knew exactly what I wanted. So when I saw the sale pop up, I had kind of already come to my conclusions of this is how I want to take the trip. This is the company I want to sail with. This is the time of season that I want to go because there are pros and cons to different months of the year. Just like with any nature-based vacation, timing becomes pretty important. So when I saw a deal, I jumped on it.
So Becky, where did you guys catch the ship and how did you get there?
So most people catch the ship from Ushuaia, Argentina, which is the very, very bottom of the South American continent. But that's what most people do. When you do that, you board the ship and the immediate first thing you get to do is sail for what's usually about 48 hours, but can often be more through the notoriously terrible Drake Passage. This sounded like a terrible way to spend 2 days there and 2 days back on your way back. So I chose a trip that left from Chile rather than Argentina and included a charter flight to a military base. I believe it was in the South Shetland Islands where you catch the ship there. So you have basically bypassed the vast majority of both the rough seas, but also just time. I shaved 4 days off the trip without seeing anything less. And that meant I got to spend 4 days in Chile with the same amount of vacation days. So it was a win-win for me.
Wow, that sounds like a shortcut if I ever heard one.
Yeah, you pay for it. So, you know, charter flights are not necessarily inexpensive, but there was nothing about this trip that was cheap. So I had already come to terms with the fact that I'd be paying for it all.
Yeah, that does seem to be the one disadvantage of Antarctic expeditions, is they really are an expedition and they have the price tag to kind of correspond.
Yeah, but I think, it sounds like the experience was well worth it. And it's interesting you mentioned spending the money to be able to save that 4 days and enjoy that in a way that you wanted to enjoy it. I think we've talked about on the podcast many, many times before, if you can trade money for time, sometimes that's the best that's the best value you can get.
Can be a bargain.
Exactly. So Becky, thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate it. You're welcome anytime. It's just been wonderful. You know, number one, to get the chance to chat again. It's been a while. I think we saw you maybe a couple of, actually it was back when you were still living in Buffalo when you were driving through. Really appreciate you sharing all of your great experiences and everything with our listeners.
I love doing it because I get so much out of what other people have shared. I feel like it's fun to kind of throw my hat in the ring and maybe somebody will learn something from me also.
I have absolutely no doubt. So as we close out, can you share with our listeners how they can find you?
Yeah, admittedly, I am harder to find these days because I've been trying to be out and enjoying life rather than glued to my phone or my computer all the time. But I am sightdoing on both Instagram and X or Twitter, however we want to refer to it these days. And I do have some old blog posts up at sightdoing.net, although I am several trips behind at this point. So bug me on social media if there is a specific place you want me to highlight that I'm just procrastinating on.
Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get even more access to in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.